Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, February 21st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. First, President Trump had to clean house and get rid of discredited National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. And then he had to find someone to take the job, made less attractive by the apparent combativeness of the president last week. He got some no's, including from the retired and well-regarded Vice Admiral Robert Harward. But President Donald Trump announced on Monday that Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster will take on the role as National Security Advisor.
He's a man of tremendous talent and tremendous experience. I watched and read a lot over the last 2 days. He is highly respected by everybody in the military, and we're very honored to have him.
He's a familiar name, but who exactly is General McMaster? Lieutenant General H.R. Herbert Raymond McMaster is a West Point graduate who earned a Silver Star for Battlefield during the 1991 Gulf War, and that's an eon ago. But he is well regarded for his tactics at first ignored by his commanders, but which proved their effectiveness on the ground after the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
I'd just like to say what a privilege it is to be able to continue serving our nation. I'm grateful to you for that opportunity, and I look forward to joining the national security team and doing everything I can to advance and protect the interests of the American people.
He's back in the thick of it now. George Packer, a staff writer at The New Yorker, first wrote about General McMaster in 2006. Welcome to The Takeaway, George.
Good to be with you, John.
What kind of general is he? Is he a tactician? Is he a manager? What are we getting here?
He's a thinker. I met him in a place called Tal Afar in northwestern Iraq early in 2006, and I knew him for two things. One was he had written a book for his doctorate at University of North Carolina called Dereliction of Duty, and it's quite a good book. It's about the failure of the Vietnam-era generals to stand up to the civilians in the Pentagon and in the White House and say that this strategy can't succeed, even though they knew it couldn't. So it's a kind of j'accuse of military irresponsibility and failure of moral courage. Then when I met him, he himself was just in the thick of trying to carry out what came to be widely known as counterinsurgency tactics and strategy in Tal Afar. And he was really the first. He was a colonel then. He commanded the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, and he was the first real implementer of counterinsurgency in Iraq. He was way ahead of the curve, and he was doing it in the teeth of Donald Rumsfeld's disapproval of the whole idea that we were even fighting an insurgency in Iraq. So he was standing up to Rumsfeld and was quite willing to be critical of Rumsfeld off the record. And so in some ways was learning the lessons of his own book and applying them to Iraq and with some success. So he was quite an impressive and thoughtful colonel then, general now.
Within the Pentagon hierarchy, he was something of an insurgent. I mean, he was a part of a whole intellectual force on counterinsurgency that rode this wave in Iraq. But I'm wondering how relevant that is now. And are we getting the tactician McMaster? Are we getting the disruptor McMaster? Or are we getting some sort of manager of chaos McMaster? Because it's a whole different situation now.
Yeah, that's my question, too. To be National Security Advisor means you have the entire world of problems on your plate every day. You have to be able to think geostrategically, to develop a close relationship with a president who in this case demands loyalty and may have a different idea every day of what the United States should be doing in a given situation. And he also has to be an honest broker of what the department heads and principals in around the government in national security think. You have to be able to give the president a range of options coming out of the top of the government. So it's an incredibly complicated job. Very few people succeed at it. And he is coming out of an entirely military tradition in which he's had this great tactical success. He is innovative. He has the courage to stand up to the people above him. so much so that he almost didn't get promoted to general at all. It took three tries, it was finally David Petraeus who secured the promotion. But he had made enough enemies above him that he nearly had to retire out as a colonel.
Well, what are the Chinese to make of this counterinsurgency expert as national security advisor? How much expertise does General McMaster have outside of these areas where he's well known and famous?
Well, counterinsurgency is not going to be applicable to much of what he does.
We perhaps
in Afghanistan, although even there we're down to about 5,000 troops, and this is nothing like counterinsurgency. So it's more the pattern of thinking that has allowed him to see the facts on the ground and adjust to them, and not to be too hidebound or too hierarchical and bureaucratic to understand what's going on and figure out what needs to be done. You know, at times when I was talking to him in Iraq, I felt that he had almost memorized counterinsurgency, and it had become something of a dogma. And that makes me wonder whether there will be other dogmas to come. He also has a lot of confidence in American power and our ability to solve problems. And it may be that 10 years on, our ability to solve problems has diminished because the problems have changed and we've changed. So he was a fellow for many years. I think he still is at the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London, which means that he's been around people who are thinking at the global level, and he's been thinking at the global level while staying within the structure of the military. I think he's a very good choice. I admire him. I like him. He's fun to be around. He's lively. He's an original. But he's going into what strikes me as being an almost impossible situation in taking on this job in the Trump White House.
George Packer, thanks so much. Staff writer at The New Yorker, talking about the new National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And let's leave you with the words of McMaster talking in somewhat indecipherable, opaque jargon about the future wars.
I think one of the things that we learned from previous efforts to develop future force capabilities was that the way we go about thinking about future war is just as important as really the thoughts that are captured in the document. Because really, what we believe our Army has to be able to do in the future and how we're going to operate in the future really rests in large measure on what the force thinks and how the force is thinking about the problem of future armed conflict and our Army's role.
That's General H.R. McMaster in 2014 discussing a Army operating concept of the future of war. A key objective of the U.S. military in the Middle East is Mosul in Iraq. Iraqi forces are in the middle of a mission to take back the western part of that city from ISIS control. The offensive started on Sunday, and some territory already has been gained. Just yesterday, Iraqi forces recaptured a key village on the way to recapturing Mosul's airport. The backdrop of this latest military push from Iraq comes with an unannounced visit from U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis to Baghdad. During his trip, Mattis was quoted as saying that the U.S., quote, is not in Iraq to seize anybody's oil. President Donald Trump, you'll recall, alarmed Iraqis during his campaign for the presidency when he said that the U.S. would just take the oil wherever we go. Joining us now is international affairs correspondent for The Guardian, Emma Graham Harrison. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you.
So is this a departure? Is this a clarification? Is the oil not in play at all anymore? Or is that a just kidding from the Secretary of Defense?
I think this was a very important visit as far as the Iraqi government was concerned. They're committed in huge amounts of money, their military, to defeating ISIS on the ground, but they can't do it without the US. They need American airstrikes. They need American backup from special forces. And so they were, I think, confused, and also there was issues of national pride to have the new president on the one hand saying that defeating ISIS was a priority, and then on the other hand saying that he planned to take Iraq's oil. Obviously, that's not something that any country would want to hear from from anybody, much less an ally. So I think it was really, really important that when this new push for the second half of Mosul began, that you had General Mattis going on the ground, personally taking on what were probably slightly difficult conversations, reassuring Iraqi generals, top Iraqi officials that actually that wasn't what the president said, perhaps slightly confusingly, wasn't America's official policy. And what seems to have been the response inside the Iraqi government has been welcoming Mattis's visit and choosing essentially to believe him rather than believe the president, unusual as that may sound.
On the ground, how important is Mosul?
Mosul is critical. I mean, ISIS has had essentially two capitals, Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq, or de facto capitals. They've been their centres of operation. And Mosul was the place where, I'm sure you remember, al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, originally announced the creation of his caliphate in 2014. So it's important strategically. It's also important in terms of morale to see Iraqi forces going back into Western Mosul, where that mosque is, where the only video known of Baghdadi making that announcement is. You know, it will be a very important message when that is taken back from Mosul. And it's a huge population center. It's the last major urban center that ISIS controls inside Iraq. You know, this is a movement that at one point controlled nearly a third of Iraqi territory and several major cities. So it won't destroy ISIS in Iraq entirely. Already many of the senior leaders have melted into the desert along the border with Syria and are expected to try and mount an insurgency from there. But it will be a very, very different enemy when it doesn't control any of these major urban centers.
Is that to say that ISIS is on its heels, is really on the verge of defeat now?
I think saying on the verge of defeat might be a little bit premature, given that they still have a strong presence in Syria. And, you know, they are melting, as I said, into these sort of rural areas where they're planning to mount an insurgency. There's also a question about as they're pushed back on the ground in what has been their core territory, are they going to try and put more effort into mounting terror attacks in the West? However, they are certainly under extreme pressure, militarily on the retreat, under very heavy pressure. There are different forces moving in on Raqqa. So certainly, I mean, ISIS, you know, is in a very, very different state, you know, to what it was a couple of years ago.
And given that ISIS is staying sort of house to house in Western Mosul, what's the chance that it's going to look like Aleppo over the next several weeks?
Certainly, it's going to be brutal street fighting. But I think what we've seen in East Mosul, which is very interesting, is that you saw a city that was much better preserved than most people had expected. And that is important in terms of people feeling that they can come home, that they can rebuild Mosul under the Iraqi government, that they have homes and a city to return to from refugee camps, which at the moment have hundreds of thousands of people in them. I mean, we've seen 200,000 people flee East Mosul since the October start of this operation. That is a huge number of refugees. And ideally, they'd be better cared for if they could come back to their home.
International affairs correspondent for The Guardian, Emma Graham Harrison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Constituent time was a bit of an eye-opener or ear-opener to the lawmakers who are choosing to put themselves on the front line, taking on difficult and sometimes spirited engagement with their constituents at town hall meetings. There's a Tea Party spirit of protest on the left and enough unease in the Republican ranks that these town meetings have become snapshots of what it looks like when divided communities take on Obamacare in the midst of repeal. Our own Washington, D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick joins me now. You chose a town meeting place somewhere near the beach, I'm figuring.
Southern Virginia in Virginia Beach, a classic swing district, John, right. Down in the Tidewater region. Lots of military down there. Look, step back. Town hall meetings all across the country are getting contentious and heated. People are describing it as a kind of reverse Tea Party. We'll see how that turns out in 2018. But Scott Taylor is a young congressman. He's just 37 years old. He's a former Navy SEAL. He's a rank freshman. I'm telling you that he's been in Congress for about 6 weeks. And those were the sounds outside of a high school last night down in Virginia Beach, John, where I went. Here are some of the sounds from inside. Lots of questions about lots of issues, but the Affordable Care Act dominated everything.
Would you please fight to keep maternity care included as an essential health benefit under any replacement of the ACA before it is repealed?
One more question as well, too, and I think yes, and
help me. Mostly worried about maternity, though.
Help me orient me to that, to fight for that, seriously.
Now, there's Scott Taylor facing constituents, and there were some organized Democrats there, John, and a lot of first-time people there, too. Hundreds of people outside, by the way, that the fire marshal wouldn't let in. Obamacare was the big issue. The GOP in the House has outlined a plan. Tax credits that aren't based on ability to pay, but based on age. Capping of Medicaid, where 12 million people at least have gained new health insurance. New emphasis on health savings accounts. The plan is starting to take shape on the Hill, and people are really, you know, I got to say, in Scott Taylor's face in the 2nd District of Virginia to find out what's going to happen to their health care.
And I know that the people are like, I want a plan right now, I want a plan right now. But what I will tell you, and I think this is... Hold on a second. Let me finish.
Now, he's, you know, freshman congressman, but is he and the GOP on the defensive on this issue?
John, it appears as though they are. The polling has changed on health care. When people had Obamacare, it barely ever broke 40% in approval. And now that the GOP has taken power and said it's time to repeal and replace, and the president, of course, has led that rhetoric, Obamacare is more popular than ever, presumably with people realizing that they may have benefits to lose now. Here is Bonnie Dingus. I spoke to her outside of the town hall. She said this is the first time she's ever come out for anything political.
Healthcare. I'm concerned about healthcare. I have custody of my 3 grandchildren. I need to have them continue to be on some kind of health insurance. I'm retired. I have pre-existing conditions. It would be a disaster for our family if too many changes were made in the Health Care Act. We would be in the breadline.
That's an interesting constituency, and probably not, you know, a small number there. A lot of people skip generations as far as grandchildren and custody and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's true. And across the country, John, a lot of GOP lawmakers are skipping town halls, opting not to have them. They don't want the confrontation. They're having them over Skype to avoid constituents getting in their faces. Some are citing safety concerns, not Democratic pressure concerns. I talked to Scott Taylor afterward about what he thinks from his young career perspective here about what's going on across the country.
We have chaos going on right now in the country. There's no doubt about it. There's a lot of division. This is not new. I mean, you know this as well, too. This was the same in 2008, 2009 with the ACA coming online. I was there, too. I went to those things. I saw those things. It was very similar. But look, I think that people are concerned. The media certainly, sorry, but the media definitely helps with that as well, too. I think the president's comments help with that as well, too. I think everybody should calm down, and it's up to leaders to be able to see clarity in chaos.
Well, it's the leadership question that's directly within his party at this point. He's not being critical, but at a certain point, he's going to have to decide, does he want to go with chaos or does he want to go with, some sort of benefit that will, meet these constituents' needs?
No question. Scott Taylor is a guy who's going to have to vote on something. Then eventually he's going to have to vote as a conservative Republican, whether to vote for whatever can get Democratic votes in the Senate. It's going to have to get to 60. Donald Trump can't snap his fingers and come up with a replacement. Now, I'll tell you, Scott Taylor is in a bit of a unique position. Donald Trump won his district by 3 points, but Taylor won by 23. That means that Donald Trump is sort of on his coattails. I said, are you afraid of if Donald Trump turns on you, attacks you? What if he tweets you?
I'm not afraid of tweets. Am I afraid of tweets? No, I'm not afraid of tweets.
If he tweets that you're failing or that you're sad.
No, I'm not. No, I'm not afraid.
I said if he tweets that.
That I am?
Yeah.
No, I'm not afraid of tweets. Look, I accept whatever the people in this district want to do. It's a huge honor and responsibility for me to be able to represent them. And I accept that they don't want me to. Period.
It's like the Lion and the Wizard of Oz.
some courage,
maybe.
I don't
believe in spooks. I don't believe in spooks.
Well, the former Navy SEAL has to show some courage. It's a politically contentious time. Lots of lawmakers have canceled their town halls. Scott Taylor in Virginia's 2nd District has not, and he's holding more tonight and tomorrow over this President's Day recess, John, that all across the country has lawmakers facing their constituents, often very angrily.
I'm not afraid of tweets. That's classic. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Gracious, great balls of fire. Kiss me, baby.
Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. For the past 25 years, musician Daryl Davis has sought out and befriended members of the Ku Klux Klan. Many of the KKK members he's met have never met a black person before. The members he's talked out of the hate group have given him their old robes and hoods. In the PBS documentary Accidental Courtesy, cameras follow Davis as he ventures across the country, from the Deep South to Los Angeles to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Davis says that typical discussions of race bore him compared to his drive to understand real hate.
Well, I realize that, you know, that the KKK is here in our country, and they are as American as baseball, apple pie, and Chevrolet. They are a part of our history. It's a shameful part of our history. And rather than try to hide it, I think it needs to be addressed. And I'm willing to take it face on, as some people are not, because, you know, they're fearful of it.
Did you ever have just pure curiosity about the KKK? You know, like, I hate them, they're scary, they're awful, but I wonder what it's like being around those guys. I mean, did you ever feel that way?
No. The way I felt was, because I've been exposed to so many different cultures. You know, I grew up as a child of parents in the U.S. Foreign Service. So I spent a lot of time overseas, you know, in Africa and Europe. And so I was constantly around different cultures, races, ethnicities, etc. So I just considered the Klan to be another culture. And my curiosity came from, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And that was what I was experiencing. So I wanted to find out the answer to that. And what better way to find out than to ask somebody who would join an organization whose whole premise is hating those who do not look like them or who do not believe as they believe.
But as a Diplo brat, which is what you are.
Exactly.
I mean, is this a form of diplomacy, kind of what you're doing here?
You know, diplomacy does come into it because, you know, that's how I grew up. You know, my father's job was going to foreign countries and bettering relations with foreign countries and the U.S. government. So I absorbed, you know, the techniques and things like that. And I employed some of these things subliminally, I guess, you know, around these people, and it became effective. I developed a lot of friends. I developed people who ended up leaving the Klan. Now, of course, you know, I know everyone that I meet is not going to leave the Klan, and there will be some who will go to their graves being hateful, violent, and racist. But, you know, if you can change one person, you can change a generation. And I never set out to convert anybody. I just set out to find out, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And in the process of trying to get the answer to that question, they discovered things about themselves that led to the answer being, they can't hate me. You know, we found more things in common than we did in contrast. And as you find more in common, a relationship is built. And as that relationship is built, a friendship is forged. And then they began shedding, you know, not only their ideology, but also their robes and hoods, which I happen to own.
Now, there's a part in the film where you encounter some Black Lives Matter folks and try to explain what it is that you're doing, and it seems as though they're giving you a lot of pushback.
So you believe that nobody can change?
No, I believe the wrong people can change.
What do you mean the wrong people can change?
White supremacists can't change.
You don't believe they can change?
White supremacists can't change. But I can change your mind because you look like me. You ain't doing nothing but collecting something that's going to build your own credibility. You nothing but a pimp in a pulpit.
And you're nothing but ignorant.
Where does that disparity come from, and how are you feeling at the time of that conversation?
You know, I understand the outrage and the rage about what's happening, you know, the racism in our country. I understand the anger behind it, but my idea is not to confront it with violence and anger and reciprocate hatred, and I oppose that. I'm not saying that all Black Lives Matter people do that, because they don't, but there's no excuse for violence or hatred or not being able to sit down at a table and talk with someone.
Give me a KKK name of someone who you either liked or found particularly memorable, interesting.
Well, the late Frank Ancona, who was the imperial wizard, which means national leader. He was the national leader of the largest Klan group in this country.
Daryl had been interviewed by different media personalities. He actually came to the defense of the traditionalist American Knights on a couple things.
While I don't necessarily agree with his separatist ideology, I consider Frank Ancona to be a friend of mine. Actually, I consider him to be a very good friend of mine. And he was just murdered just a few days ago.
How did you feel about that?
I feel terrible about it.
Did you ever feel in danger?
Yes. You know, when I was in danger, I mean, there have been times when I had to fight and put somebody in the hospital or put somebody in jail just to protect my, you know, my own well-being. I've been threatened before. But fortunately, those times have been few and far between.
You have mentioned that you sometimes feel safer talking to the KKK than with members of the police.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, when you see a robe and a hood and people telling you, you know, to your face, you know, where they're coming from and what they believe, there's no reason to doubt them. But, you know, when you see someone in a uniform with a badge and a gun, you only know what they are supposed to stand for, not necessarily what they do stand for. And, you know, one's perception is one's reality. And I don't want to paint the police, you know, with a broad brush either, because there are many decent, honest cops, but there are many who are not. And that's very unfortunate. You know, if you were to ask 10 of your white guy friends this question, say to them, what would be the first thing that goes through your mind if you're driving home late at night, 2 o'clock in the morning from a date or your night shift or whatever it is you're on, and you see those lights flashing in your rearview mirror, obviously you're being pulled over, what's the first thought that goes through your mind? I'll guarantee you 10 out of 10 of them are going to say, I hope I don't get a ticket. I hope my insurance doesn't go up. I hope I don't get points on my license. And you pose that same question to 10 of your black male friends, I'll guarantee you 10 out of the 10 of them are going to say, I hope I don't get shot. I hope I don't get beat up. You know, they're not worried about the insurance or the ticket. They're worried about their life.
With your experience all around the world and growing up as a son of a Foreign Service officer, have you thought of graduating from talking to the KKK to talking to, say, Boko Haram?
People have asked me about that, too. Would those techniques work? I believe they would work. You know, but it takes someone who has studied and knows the ins and outs and the ideology of Boko Haram in order to do that. I have studied extensively on white supremacy, black supremacy, and that kind of thing, which has enabled me to sit down and have conversations that have been effective. Unless I would study Boko Haram, I would not be effective in doing it.
If you ever do open up a museum, how many robes and hoods do you have so far?
I've got about 30 now, and I keep getting them, and I will continue to get them. But, you know, it's not just robes and hoods. I have a lot of other Klan and neo-Nazi paraphernalia, you know, that will go inside the museum.
Daryl Davis, it's been a delight. Musician, speaker, author, subject of the film, Accidental Courtesy, Daryl Davis, Race and America. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
You can watch the film online. Visit the Independent Lens site on PBS.org. Putting on a happy face on Facebook turned out to be a felony for Lester Packingham back in 2010. He beat a parking ticket and wanted to tell the whole world, bad idea. Man, God is good, he posted on his social media account. How about I got so much favor they dismissed the ticket before court even started? No fine, no court costs, no nothing spent. Praise be to God. Wow, thanks, Jesus. But Lester, who goes by the name of JR, is a registered sex offender. In North Carolina, where Lester lives, it is a felony to access any commercial social networking website, in this case Facebook, that he or she knows does not restrict membership to adults. A police officer saw the post. Lester was convicted of the felony of going online and talking about a traffic ticket. But this case has made it all the way to the Supreme Court. Oral arguments are scheduled for next week. Lester's case is the latest installment of our twice-a-month series with the Marshall Project, Case in Point. Joining us is Andrew Cohen, commentary editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, and Glenn Girding, North Carolina appellate defender, who has been representing Lester in his legal battles.
This case is not about whether they will be on the registry for the rest of their lives, but whether they will be banned from using social media like Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, Skype, media platforms like that for the rest of their lives.
And Andrew Cohen, how unusual is it to follow defendants after they've served their time and continue to punish them in various ways.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I took this case and saw this case as a perfect case in point, John. This is a big deal across the country. Collateral consequences is essentially the concept. So you're punished for a crime. If you're a sex offender, it's a sex crime. You spend time in prison, perhaps, although this defendant did not for his crime. And then after you get out, you are essentially subject to a life sentence where you are forbidden from taking part in the everyday activities of the nation. In this case, a fascinating case where a man who long ago had been punished for a crime goes to Facebook because he gets a traffic ticket dismissed, a parking ticket. And he says, glory be to God. This is great. Thanks, Jesus. He's having a good day. Unbeknownst to him, the police are essentially monitoring him, Facebook, and they notice that, hey, here's the guy who we think is a sex offender. And so they essentially charge him and then convict him of a crime. And so the idea that you cannot go on Facebook to express a glee over the dismissal of a ticket, to me, is a sort of a striking example of overcriminalization. And that's why we picked this case.
But Lester Packingham was on a registered sex offender list. Do those lists distinguish between what kinds of offenses they are, from the violent to the very, very, I don't even know what to say. I mean, there's no sex offense that, I approve of.
The short answer is no. Once you make it onto the list, you're onto the list and you're not able to do certain things. The question in this case, as Glenn says, is not the list or who's on it, but what kind of conduct triggers punishment for being on the list. When you go on Facebook, and you can understand to an extent why North Carolina is doing this, North Carolina is concerned that sexual predators are going to be online looking for new victims and trying to solicit new victims or entice new victims. And at that point, they feel like public safety warrants this sort of a protection. What the Lester Packingham and his lawyers say, and we can ask Glenn himself, is this just goes too far. This is not dangerous conduct. This is not dangerous speech. This is basically being punished for the very act of having a Facebook account and checking in on it from time to time.
We're not challenging the list itself at this point. What we're challenging is this law that is strikingly broad in the people that it covers. It includes everybody who has been convicted of anything from misdemeanor sexual battery, a misdemeanor, all the way up to the most serious sex offenses, all the way up to the rest of their lives. So we're talking about the breadth of the statute, the websites that it covers, the people that it covers, and that there's no individualized determination of who should be prohibited from using these websites. There's never been an allegation in this case that my client, and he goes by JR, that JR used a computer in this case or has ever used one in an inappropriate manner. And that's the problem with this statute. It just simply doesn't take into account the individualized situations of each person.
How serious in the state and nationally is this predation issue that constantly drives these very, very tough laws?
Well, in North Carolina, the state has never come forward with any statistics or proof of using these social media platforms to stalk children. In fact, every one of these cases that I've seen and that I'm aware of has been someone who has simply been using social media as it is intended to be used for innocent purposes, just like in this case. Or you've got somebody that uses Instagram or YouTube or Skype or something in an innocent manner, just like everybody else does in their daily lives, and then suddenly they are arrested, their homes are searched, they're brought into court, they're indicted, they're prosecuted, they're tried, they're convicted, they're a convicted felon because of this. So the state has never put forward that information, at least not in court, to show that this is a problem that requires this broad of a solution.
Andrew Cohen, is America unusual in the way that we deal with these kinds of crimes?
I think we're unusual, and I think what Glenn is pointing to is the problem here. I don't think anybody denies that there is concern, there is worry. There's a public safety issue in trying to ensure that someone who is convicted of a serious sex offense isn't out there praying online, using the new technology to get a new victim. The problem for North Carolina, the problem in these other states as well, is that there's a gulf between what the problem is, what the worry is, and what the remedy is. And I think this is one of those cases that tests that. And that's why it's fascinating that there's so many different people on different sides of the ideology spectrum siding with Mr. Packingham here. The Cato Institute is on the same side as the defense attorneys and the ACLU, for example, all saying this is just too broad, that North Carolina has to think more closely and come up with a more refined solution to what everybody concedes is a problem.
It's a 4-4 court. What does that mean?
I don't think this is going to be one of those cases that comes down along ideological lines. I think this is going to be a fascinating oral argument, first of all, but I don't think it's going to be one of those ties that goes to the runner that goes back to North Carolina. I think this is going to be a definitive ruling from the Supreme Court. They have lots of options when it comes to the First Amendment. There are lots of ways they can say to North Carolina, look, you need to do this over. You need to come up with a more refined solution. I think the justices took the case because it's not just happening in North Carolina. It's happening all over. And of course, as new technology advances, as more people get online, this becomes more and more of a concern.
Andrew Cohen is commentary editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. And Glenn Girding is a North Carolina appellate defender who's been representing Lester Packingham in his legal battle. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com. And Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Net neutrality advocates got some bad news with the ascension of Ajit Pai to be FCC chairman, as it appears that Pai wants to largely reverse the Obama administration's approach to the internet. But here's one change the new FCC may want to accelerate in 2017. We've seen an unprecedented amount of activity on the state level in regards to broadband access debates. Large telecommunications monopolies are digging their heels in on a number of issues, and in some places, citizens are effectively fighting back. Christopher Mitchell is the director of Community Broadband Networks at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
The number one thing is that it has to come about organically. So it's not something that, you know, me as a puppeteer can orchestrate from far away. What we see is local businesses that are generally the ones to start advocating, saying we need this connectivity to make sure we're competitive in our industries, and we cannot get it from the private sector at a reliable, affordable price. So what happens then is that local governments start to look at it. They see what other local governments have done. A lot of times they'll actually riff on those models, and we see new models developing. But fundamentally, it's a very organic, bottom-up kind of process.
Is the model for this the public utility districts of the 1930s and 40s?
In some areas, in rural areas, I think that's the case. And in some ways, you might say that Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration is probably going to be more responsible for high-quality internet access investment in rural areas than any administration since, because it's those rural co-ops that are often the ones driving the highest quality networks in rural areas.
And where are people getting their main internet access? Is it from cable companies? Is it from some special service that was like a wholesaler? I don't quite understand how the retail and wholesale thing works.
You know, in rural areas, you actually have these electric co-ops and telephone co-ops. They're often offering either retail or wholesale services. Electric co-ops in particular, some do retail and some will actually just focus on the wires and let other entities like nearby co-ops offer the services over their networks instead. Now, in cities, you also have a variety of models where it really depends on the local government's willingness to get in and to try and compete directly with the cable or telephone companies. I think what we'll see more commonly is cities that are trying to invest in networks that will enable other ISPs, private companies, nonprofits, who knows, to compete with the big cable and telephone companies rather than having the city doing it themselves. It's a model kind of like the roads, where the city doesn't run all the trucks, the city just provides the roads.
Do you think that this proliferation of internet services and the local initiatives that are in very varied ways, as you're describing, are getting broadband and internet service to all sorts of places around the country where the private sector dares not tread, will eventually result in a legal definition of broadband or internet service as
essentially a right in America, not simply a service?
You know, it's interesting because there's a lot of talk about rights, and I don't even know if I have a right to electricity, but I know that we expect it everywhere. And that's a norm. And that's what I'm a little bit more interested in, is making sure that people can expect it. And I think that will be the case. The biggest problem right now for not expecting any access is in rural areas. And I do think that as the historic rural cooperatives, both telephone and electric, have more opportunity to expand, rural areas will have that option. Now, in cities, you often have connectivity if you can pay for it, but you may not be able to pay for it. And that's a much bigger problem that I think local governments will increasingly wrestle with. You may see a municipality coming up with solutions for low-income areas to make sure that they can have all of the benefits of connectivity in the modern age, which I think is just really important for making sure that the children are able to do better than their parents, which, you know, you might think of as the American dream, of course.
Christopher Mitchell is Director of Community Broadband Networks at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in a case contending that Mexicans on Mexican soil have U.S. constitutional protections in some cases. In June of 2010, Sergio Adrian Hernandez Guareca was shot and killed by U.S. Border Patrol agent Jesus Mesa Jr. on the border between El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. At the time of the killing, Hernandez was on Mexican soil and Mesa was on U.S. soil. Hernandez was just 15 years old. Are people within sight of the U.S. border but not standing on U.S. territory protected by U.S. constitutional rights? Margaret Hu is an associate professor of law at Washington and Lee University in Virginia. She joins me now. What's the issue here?
Well, the Supreme Court today is going to decide a few questions on whether or not Hernandez can claim constitutional rights, as you stated. So among the constitutional rights that they are claiming is that even though Hernandez was standing on Mexican soil when he was shot, that he can nonetheless claim a Fourth Amendment right against unlawful, unconstitutional, lethal violence against him, as well as a Fifth Amendment due process right.
And I can't believe this case hasn't come to the Supreme Court before. You know, what are cases that come close to examining this same issue?
Well, among the cases that Hernandez is relying on is the Boumediene case, which was a Guantanamo case. So even though the detainees were not on U.S. soil, they were nonetheless claiming that they had a right to habeas corpus or that they had constitutional rights. And the Supreme Court had to decide whether or not, even though there was not formal sovereignty rights that could be extended to those in Guantanamo Bay, whether or not functionally they could extend constitutional rights to those who were extraterritorially located. And so the factors that they considered were whether or not the characteristics of the person warranted the constitutional rights, the location of the relevant events, and also the practical obstacles that would be posed in the application of extending extraterritorially those constitutional rights.
In terms of surveillance on the border, where you could see maybe 2 miles past the actual U.S. border line, Border Patrol agents are suddenly going to have a different set of rules if the court rules for Guareca.
Yeah, the Supreme Court in a 1990 case, for example, is a Verdugo-Urquidez case, stated that there were no Fourth Amendment rights that could extend to those extraterritorially, so those who were not here in the United States. And so that's been a real question with surveillance harms, for example, with mass surveillance, whether or not you could extend Fourth Amendment protections, which also protect against unwarranted, unreasonable searches and seizures, to those who might be impacted by U.S. policies, but who do not physically reside within the United States. And so that's certainly a question that the government is saying should be resolved in their favor.
What about within sight lines of the U.S. Border when there is better technology to see people from farther away?
Well, I think that that is going to be an increasing concern because there are questions of whether or not we're militarizing the border and whether or not we are now deploying the most sophisticated mass surveillance technologies at the border. And so some would argue that that is a reason for extending constitutional rights at the border, that if the border is within our control and our monitoring constantly, that physically standing on one side of the border shouldn't make a difference, that functionally the people standing on that side of the border still fall within the control and responsibility of the United States, and that actions taken by the U.S. Border Patrol, including killing an individual, should fall within constitutional protections.
Margaret Hu is an associate professor of law at Washington and Lee University in Virginia. Thanks so much, Margaret.
Sure, thank you.
A humble bistro in central France called La Bouche à Oreille was floored to learn it had received a coveted Michelin star. Meanwhile, an upscale eatery outside Paris by the same name was surprised to see it had not. The star was meant for the pricey place, but you won't see this on the next episode of Cutthroat Kitchen. No, the owners have called each other up and each extended a standing invitation to the other to dine at the other's restaurant. Peace in our time. Sounds like you'd be in good hands at either of those places. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.